Hello and welcome to Fantasy Talks Live, the podcast that came out of the Jose's Amazing World's YouTube channel. Original video recordings of all the episodes in the podcast can be found at Jose's Amazing World's in YouTube. Listeners beware, as plot spoilers can be discussed in any of the episodes in the podcast. And now, without further delay, enjoy the show.
And hopefully we are live. So hello everyone, if everyone is watching now. So I'm here joined by Derry and Julian to discuss the Farseer trilogy by American author Robin Hobb, in which probably is going to be a very spoiler-filled discussion, I hope. We're going to try to unpick
and see what's what.
And hopefully we're going to have different opinions. So I think maybe to kick it off, Derry, just a very sort of brief summary overall, how you feel about this trilogy.
Okay. I adore this trilogy and all of the books that come after it. I am obsessed. I have been reading it annually since 2001. So you could say I'm a fan.
Wow. Yeah. Sounds like it. Julian?
Well, I really enjoyed this trilogy as well. I remember going into it with all of the assassin in the titles that I wasn't really sure what to expect. I thought it's going to be a lot of action. I'm usually not that kind of person who gravitates towards that, but it was wonderful. And I know that a lot of people say that this is like the weakest one and it only gets better. I don't really agree. I'm currently 11 books into The Realm of the Elderlings, and so far they're just all amazing. So it's very difficult to rate them and to say like this one is better than this one. For me, it was just amazing from the start. And I'm a sucker for like coming of age stories. So of course I'm going to love the Farseer trilogy.
Yeah, well, I think clearly we've got our ranking here because I wasn't as enamored by this trilogy, but mostly to do with the ending. I actually really enjoyed everything about it, except for the ending. But I have to say, after having continued, having read Lightship Traders and the next trilogy, and now I'm finishing Rain Wild, I understand the ending better. But at the time, when I read it as a standalone trilogy, I felt a little bit cheated of that big battle at the end. But now I understand why. But at the time when I read it, I was a little bit disappointed.
Totally valid.
All right. So, Julian, you're not a big fan of big battles. So how do you feel about maybe not getting that payoff at the end? If Julian's still here. Seems to have. So, Derry, do you agree with me on that?
I do agree with you. You make a very good point. I think for me, much like Jolene, I'm not a fan of big battles either. So it didn't really bother me. Because I'd become so attached to Fitz as a character, I really only wanted to know what was going to impact him. So the ending for me worked perfectly fine. But when I look back on it, I can totally see why people feel shortchanged about the way that it ends, because all of these things are built up and built up and built up, and then they get kind of, okay, and that's done. and you're left with no sense of completion or closure on a lot of those things. And as you said, you don't find out really why until so much later, which is great if you read that far ahead, but it doesn't change the fact that it is a bit dissatisfying in that first time through. So, yeah, I do agree completely with what you said.
Yeah, because what I understood later after having read it, having thought about it, and I think I felt validated in my opinion in the, what was the third trilogy?
The Tawny Man.
That's the one. So, because our main character, Fitz, is not the hero of the story.
No.
The real hero of the story is Prince, help me out. Is it Verity?
Verity. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the one that goes on the quest. He's the one that does all the heroic deeds. He's the one that saves the kingdom and fits in kind of our, I don't know, fly on the wall almost character.
No, you are right. I think, and this is something I try and let new readers know, is it's Fitz's story. And as you said, he's not the hero of the story. He's the person who makes the story possible. The Fool talks about it, obviously, in his role as catalyst, in that these things can't happen if Fitz hasn't created the situation for that to happen in. And the smallest decisions that Fitz makes has some really long-term effects, sometimes that you don't see for books and books and books. And then you think, oh, I know now what started that. And that was a decision that Fitz made way back then. But when you're looking at it from a story point of view, yes, Verity is the hero of that trilogy. You know, he's got the love story. He gets the betrayal, and he gets all of those key moments that you usually associate with the hero. He gets those moments. And Fitz just kind of sits a step back and makes those things possible. So,
And I suppose maybe it's a bit of a different take on the fantasy genre, isn't it? We are so used to following the main protagonist and the main hero or anti-hero, as the case may be, that it took a while for it to click and go, oh, actually, I know why this is happening now the way it is. Mm. But, you know, I suppose if you read it with the expectation that Fitz is going to save the day, that he's going to be the one to wake the dragons and all the stuff, you are going to be disappointed. It requires a little bit of an adjustment.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, and I've said this a lot over the years, the titles of the books don't help, because it makes them sound very action-packed and it makes them sound really exciting. And while a lot of really intense things happen, they're not that high adrenaline, fast-paced action kind of story. They're stuff happens. It's usually not great, and Fitz has to try and get through them so that people can reach the next stage of their story. So if you've gone in with that expectation that the main character is going to be the hero and a book called Assassin's Apprentice is going to be exciting, and neither of those things happen.
You're right. I think I agree with you there, but to address Shadia's point here, yes, Fitz wake the dragons. I had this conversation with people online, but the person that rides to battle, the person that drives away the people from the whatever islands they're called, is not Fitz. He takes a massive backseat in the final resolution of the big conflict that we've been dealing throughout the whole trilogy. And I think later on, and I don't want to jump into any of the other trilogies, but in Tallyman, he actually says, I'm not a hero. Like, it's almost like Robin Hobb is telling us that, you know, Fitz is not going to be the person that saves the day necessarily. Well, that's my interpretation.
No, you're right. He's not the person history will remember as the key person at that point of the Six Duchies. And part of that's deliberate, obviously. He wants to remain dead, because, you know, let's face it, he's dead to most of the Six Duchies. And one of the quieter kind of themes that underlies it is that everybody's a hero by enabling the hero in other people. I think that the example that's used in the book is the blacksmith who helps reshoe a horse so that the king can get to battle. That's an essential moment. And if that didn't happen, the king wouldn't go on to win the battle. So the blacksmith is the hero, but the king gets the reward for winning the battle. And I think Robin Hobb makes a big deal about the fact that if you live in the now with the understanding that what you do now is as important as winning that battle for your country, as flying the dragon, that moment is as powerful. So you have to make those choices accordingly. And I love that so much. It's so empowering to live that way.
Yeah, he's not the hero in the traditional sense, or maybe what we've been used to in fantasy. Right, there are many, 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 many very good things that Robin Hobb does in the series. But we can discuss them later. I just want to look at what may not actually have worked. And I've only got, apart from the ending, I only had one other gripe with the series, or this trilogy in particular. I think she's got better in later books, but it's characterization of the antagonist. I think in this trilogy, Prince Verity's brother, and again, you will know better than me, that was Regal. Queen, that's the one. And he is such a, to me, such a pantomime villain.
It's the moustache-twirling villain.
To the point where he doesn't make intelligent decisions because he's the evil guy. And he would, like, at one point, he wants to split the kingdom, and he's happy to keep a smaller part of the six duchies just so that he can be king. And it's like, no, you're not. I know you're evil. I know you're the antagonist, but that doesn't mean you have to be stupid about it or take dumb decisions about it. And I think, to me, that was a bit of a letdown in the trilogy.
I agree with you. Regal is very moustache twirly. He is very evil for evil's sake. I mean, I've read it a lot, so I know that there is more there. But if you don't know to be looking for it, it's not easily seen. There is quite a lot of not so much backstory as the inference of how much he's being, not manipulated, he's having his reality defined by his mother, and that relationship we see better in Tawny Man through old letters, and Fitz being older, he's got a bit of hindsight and he can understand some of the motivations that Regal had. But they're all there in Farcia. You just don't recognize what they are because Fitz is telling you from a child's perspective. So the things that he's saying, he's interpreting as simple selfishness, simple pettiness, bullying. But the actual words being used by Regal are things that people around them have said, that the Queen has said. So there's a layer of a child that's been brought up to believe that Fitz has arrived here deliberately to do Regal out of a throne, despite the fact Fitz really couldn't care less. But Regal believes it, like really believes it. And I mean, I don't know if you had anything like that in your childhood or if anyone around you did, but where they just had a wrong idea from really early on. It can take a lot to see the reality that everyone else can see. And I think that's what the problem with Regal was. That wasn't written clearly enough in Farcia.
Right. I think we have Julian back. Fell off the chair there.
Just trying to see how I can have a salad. So, almost there.
Right. Oh, I agree, Shadia. Yes, Galen was a bit more evil.
So, and again, remind me, I think Galen was the one
he was the skill master.
The one running the coterie of. I don't think he was necessarily. Yeah, he was villainous. He was antagonist, but he was not the villain.
He wasn't portrayed as the villain.
He was a well-crafted antagonist to Fitz.
He was well-crafted. And I think, again, and she got much better at this as the series went on, so much of it wasn't made clear quite enough in that because I've read it so often, I know it's there and so I can see it. But first-time readers might miss it really quickly in that Galen is Regal's brother. Mm-hmm. They have the same mother. They have a connection that's far deeper than anybody in the court realizes. So there's motivation for them to work together. There's motivation for Galen to be treating Fitz so abominably, on top of the fact that it's a reaction from what Fitz's father did to Galen as a young man. So all of those layers can be quite easily sort of skipped over on your first read, because they're all kind of sprinkled through the book, and so you don't pile them up as clearly. And this is why I say to people, the Farseer trilogy does so much better on a reread, which is awful because you want it to stand on its own the first time you read it.
Yeah.
But it just really does improve.
Just to summarise for Julian while she falls the chair there.
Sorry.
we were talking about how I thought, and Derry agreed with me, that Regal is a bit of a pantomime villain, that he's not... Mm-hmm. Just because he's the antagonist, he doesn't need to make dumb decisions just for the sake of being evil. And we thought that was one of the weaker probably one of the only two weak points in the trilogy.
To be honest, this was also on my notes, so I completely agree. And I actually think that one of the weaker points, but I was loving the trilogy so much when I read it that I didn't really care that much. But if you think about it more critically, I think that sometimes Regal got away with things that I didn't really found very realistic. I thought that from the start, it's very clear what he's doing. I think that Verity knows what he's doing. So I understand that there's a power struggle being from a different mother. And of course, Regal has a lot of advantages. But I still thought that sometimes he should have hit a brick wall. And that didn't happen nearly enough. So I think that she definitely gets better in characterizing her villains in the Life of Traitors trilogy and later on. So I can definitely forgive her because it improves. But that's maybe one of the weaker points here. Although I must also say that maybe we don't really see everything that's happening because we are watching it from Fitz's POV. And of course, especially at the start, he's very young. So you don't know if he knows all of the intrigues that are actually happening. But still.
Yeah. So I think those are the only two kind of points of criticism or dislike or whatever you want to call them about this trilogy is the ending, which if you approach them with a traditional mindset, you may feel disappointed, and the poor characterization of the antagonist. But now, let's just smoke.
I would actually really like to know what you thought of the situation with Nosy, the first puppy that Fitz bonded with, in that very early on in the series, there's that heartbreaking moment where they're separated, and very much later you get that reconnection and he has to reorder all of the beliefs he has about Burrick. And how did that impact how you saw both Burrick and Fitz? I'd love to know.
Julian, take it away.
I honestly thought that Burrick had killed Nosy. And looking back on it, maybe that's a little bit strange because Burrick had such a strong connection to animals that it would be out of character for him to just kill that puppy because of a fault that Fitz made and not a fault of the puppy itself. But still, I thought that he killed him and I was so angry with Burrick. It was until I knew that Nosy was still alive, I hated him. And I think that for Fitz, he felt the same. So even if you maybe knew as a reader that that didn't happen, because I have heard some people say, I never believed that Nosy was truly dead. I'm more stupid, so I did believe that full on. But even if you know what happened, you know what Fitz was thinking. And he really thought that his most prominent father figure, the only one that he really had, I think at that time point, he betrayed him in an awful way. So I think that especially when you have trust issues, and you see that later on as well, that this had a big impact on Fitz.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I read these 2 or 3 years ago, but it's all sort of coming back as you mentioned it. I think something that Robin Hobb does exceptionally well is relationships between characters, and that relationship between Fitz and Burrick, you feel it, you get it, you understand why Burrick does the things that he does. He's this sort of maybe very traditional, strict foster father figure type thing, and ultimately you may agree or disagree with his methods, but it's undeniable that he's got Fitz's best interest, mm-hmm. or he's trying everything he does because he cares about him, and because yeah. from his own experience, as we find later on,
yeah.
he knows what's the best thing for him, even though Fitz doesn't know it yet. And I mean Robin Hood, for me, in all her books, as a father, as a parent, there are so many things that I can see myself represented there in my daily struggles with my children. And when you tell them off, when you have to be strict, when you have to do all these things that you cannot explain to a kid, but you have to do for their sake. And I think she obviously has got the very honing skill for writing relationships and creating characters.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then help me out here, because this is something I don't really care much in my fantasy, but some people I've seen other reviewers praise the handling of Fitz's relationship with candle-making girl.
Molly,
because yeah. I was thinking about B, but that's his.
That's much later.
So I didn't really care much about it. I think it was like okay, yeah, that is a believable relationship, but is it as masterful as some people make it out?
No. No. I don't think so. I find Molly to be probably one of the, I don't know, the least three-dimensional almost mm-hmm. of the characters. That there's not a lot to Molly, but I think that that's indicative of how Fitz sees her. You never feel that he's had to get to know Molly or find more things out about her. He just loves her. So for that reason, I mean, obviously, yay, go Fitz. Be in love with Molly. But as a person, I never learned enough about her to feel connected. So I kind of didn't care. And I kind of never did.
I'm a little bit similar. I felt a little bit frustrated when I read about the two of them. At the same time, I think that that's realistic for how old they were. And these were two teenagers with a lot of baggage. So, of course, it's going to be a problematic relationship. So it's almost like it needed to be there, but I would have been fine if it wasn't there. It was one of my least favorite moments, just because I could feel the frustration of just talk to each other. And you don't need to stay with the person that you met just because they're the first person that you laid eyes on and you have a connection. That doesn't mean that you need to stay together if it becomes toxic. So,
Is it a case Is it a case of box ticking? Like, we need to have a love interest, we need to have a relationship for our main character, therefore I'm going to write this thing in?
I think she was probably necessary, particularly in Royal Assassin. I think he needed to be pulled in multiple directions about his loyalty and where his attention should be. And obviously, as the series progresses, that had repercussions. So in Farseer, I think it was just needing to question where his loyalties lay and where he saw the importance of his daily activities. And so I think, yes, she was necessary. I just would have liked her to be more. So, yeah.
I get that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I felt very similar about that. I wish I would have seen more of her, because even though some characters were not as likable as I would have liked them to be, at least I could understand them. While with Molly, yes, you have, of course, her childhood, and that plays a very big part. But other than that, there were just some instances that I thought, now you're just being mean or difficult, almost for the sake of being mean and difficult and for the sake of being an obstacle in the story. So looking at it like that, I do understand Jose saying, is this something that she wanted to put in just to have it there? At the other hand, I think that she also looks at the flaws of that relationship, and like people in the chat are saying as well, it does have repercussions later on. And especially in that third book, you see what happens when you don't really nurture a relationship like you should.
Absolutely. I would actually be interested to know, though, how old did you think Burek was in Farsia? Like, what sort of age gap were you looking at? Because this is something I've encountered for so many years, and it always fascinates me where people think Burek's age lays.
Well, when I first read it, I thought he was extremely old. Like, I'm going to offend people here. Not extremely old. I thought that he was like 50, maybe. And then afterwards, I realized that's not possible. This is probably just because I'm looking at it from Fitz's POV, who, as a child, he thinks that everybody above 30 is like elderly. So I had to rearrange that thought. But throughout, when I read it for the first time, I thought that he was pretty old.
Yeah. And you're saying?
No, I think, considering the whole medieval setting type thing, I would have put him in his somewhere in his early 40s or so, you know, because everyone was a lot more precocious about relationships, having children and all the stuff. And I think in my head, he was somewhere there. But yeah, not something that terribly bothered me there.
Because I know it bothers quite a lot of people. You know, I haunt a lot of hob threads. So, I can quite easily be summoned. A lot of people have a problem with the relationship Burek ends up in because of the age difference. And I have to really constantly remind people it's not actually that big an age gap for, as you said, for this time period. And also, Molly's older than Fitz. So that age gap is even smaller than you think it is. And I just find it really interesting that child's perspective that you mentioned, Jolene, of Burek being old sticks with you, even as your thinking brain could quite easily go, no.
Exactly.
But you don't, because you're getting Fitz's view of this much older person. Mm-hmm. So I really do find that interesting, that's what sticks.
I mean, maybe this is for next trilogy's conversation, but I mean, and then I know, Jolene, you've recently had that video about what is grimdark, and I'm not going to call Robin Hobb grimdark, but man, if she has to mess up one of her characters, she's going to do it. She's going to go places. She's going to not treat them very nicely. And it's not so evident here, but in the later books. So, to be honest, that people may have an issue with an age gap in a relationship, you don't know. You're like, you should pass the next few books.
This is very true. Having said that, there are some moments in Farsia that are really dark. I mean, Fitz literally goes berserk over a dead child. I mean, there's some dark moments in Farsia. There are some very hard-hitting, in-your-face, people-can-suck moments in Farsia. But it's hard to imagine calling Robin Hobb grimdark, because there's such a heart to it that you almost don't know. I mean, it's there, you read it, you know that you've just read something awful, but it somehow doesn't have that attacking feel that you can sometimes get.
Yeah.
But yes, it's she certainly knows how to hurt them.
Yeah. Moving on, I'm going to go completely off. I mean, just jumping topics here, but something that no, I don't want to say noticed, but something I thought, like the impression I got is that Elden Ring's series seems to be more popular with female readers than the male readers. But I could be wrong, but this is my perception from seeing on YouTube was available.
Yeah.
And she does touch on issues of sexuality. And to me, the magic systems, the way I saw the, because we've got two magic systems here, don't we? We've got the skin, which is this kind of telepathy type thing. And then we've got kind of something similar, which is related to bonding animals and building this weird, very close relationship with animals. And the human acquires certain traits of that particular animal, which is frowned upon, which is not socially accepted, which is like a big no-no. And the way I interpreted that or related that was that that's kind of that was the skill for animal bonding. Come on, it's not skilling, it's what's it called in the series?
The wit.
The old blood. Yeah.
That having the wit was kind of that world's homosexuality from a few decades back. I could be wrong, but that's how I related it in when I read the books.
I think the level of bigotry is definitely paralleled. And I need to ask, did you read The Willful Princess and The Piebald Prince? No. Okay, because I know I made Yolene read it.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Because I think that helps a lot. Mm-hmm. But I read that after I'd read the whole series. So I'd be really interested to know how that affected how you saw the magic systems.
I
just wanted to say that you definitely need to read it, Jose, because it helps to explain where those prejudices come from.
Right.
Yeah, because it is a bigotry, like you get around homosexuality. That's I would definitely recommend that you give that a read. I mean, it's beautiful in itself. It's a Robin Hood book set in the Six Duchies. It's beautiful. But it does give you insight into why the wit became so hated and became so socially shunned, where previous to that story it hadn't been. So I think it's, oh my God, Shadia, really? Are we going to go there? This is a bit like Stephen King's moment in the book It. We don't talk about that, but
I don't know. I mean, question: did Robin Hood? What do you think she planned out the whole Elderlings?
I know that she didn't. I've read a lot of interviews over the years, and she wrote Farcia. And keep in mind how critical The Fool is to the whole series. The Fool was only ever supposed to come in for one scene. He was supposed to arrive in the garden to give his riddle to Fitz, and we were never supposed to see him again. He was never a part of the story that Robin Hobb thought she was telling. So when he wouldn't leave and kept coming back into the story while she wrapped up Farcia, I think it took her a little while to figure out how she was going to keep The Fool as such a clearly integral part of the series. And if you've read Beyond Tawny Man, you know that Tawny Man finishes. It's a complete arc. You could stop reading at the end of Tawny Man and be completely satisfied. But she has a whole other arc that she wants to explore. And again, that wasn't planned. So there weren't any threads created to start that off with any kind of momentum. She had to literally start again to build that arc. So Farcia was supposed to be the end, which justifies the difficulties with the ending of Farcia, because if that is all that there was, it wouldn't be a fabulous series. Mm-hmm. Tawny Man was an end to the story. That was it. It was over. And that, I think, is why the Rainwilds get so much bad press, because it did have to start from nothing. And it, so it took that much longer to gain that momentum to get back into it for Fitz in the Fall. So no, she didn't plan the whole series.
But you've opened the floodgates there, and then Shari has made the comment. Isn't the Fool one of the most intriguing, interesting characters in all of fantasy?
Wow, yeah.
Literature.
I do. I love the Fool. How did you feel about in Assassin's Quest, Jose, when Starling questioned the Fool's sexuality? How did you feel about that situation that happened?
Like, I've said this many times, like, I don't really care for the sexuality of characters in anything I read. Possibly as much as I don't care about any people that I meet in real life. Mm-hmm. But Robin Hood does bring it to, and it plays a part. It is important to the characters and the situations. At the time, I think it kind of passed me by. I don't really care. Later on, in Tournament, it's much more obvious why. And there's some very in-depth conversations between Fitz and the Fool. But that's a conversation for next time.
That's another day.
But for me, this time around, I think probably that passed me by. Maybe I don't really care about that kind of thing, unless it becomes pivotal to the story that she was trying to tell. And maybe it passed me by, maybe they didn't pay attention, maybe they didn't care at the time. I was indifferent about that.
Because was it you, Arlene, that was angry with Starling? I know somebody I was talking to got really angry with Starling.
I think it's possible that was me, but I'm not quite sure. It's been a while since I read it, but was Starling quite aggressive while asking her question? Yeah, then it could be me. Well, at the same time, I do understand where that's coming from in that world. But knowing Starling and knowing her background, I thought that she would be a little bit more understanding about the entire situation. So I didn't really cut her a lot of slack. I must say that Starling is also just a character in general that I don't like that much. I think that sometimes she can be very mean. So maybe that didn't help.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. It was one even from way back when I first read it over 20 years ago. And keep in mind, most modern fantasy really kind of kicked in quite recently. This was one of the first times I'd encountered a character that wasn't cisgendered presenting. And I thought it was handled beautifully. Because Fool had the confidence about themselves to go, what do you care what I've got in my pants? Yeah. And I just really loved that we had this character who was sort of androgynous, who denied gender and refused to be baited into proving himself or herself or themselves. I don't know. It was the first time I'd encountered it in a book, and I remember thinking it had been dealt with really well.
Yeah. So I think that she definitely was ahead of her time. Now, I must say that in that time period, I don't really read a lot of fantasy, but I've never really heard of characters that are just so naturally put into that story and that help for just in general the representation of everyone. Mm. That's something that we see now, but sometimes I have a feeling that it's shoehorned in, while Robin Hobb can really do it in a very natural way.
Yeah, I think the only open, as far as I'm aware, the only other openly homosexual character I encountered in fantasy was in Trudy Canavan's The Black Magician trilogy, where one of the characters is gay, and again, it's taboo and all the stuff. But to me, that didn't work because it didn't matter to the story other than, yeah, here's a gay person. Okay, fine. Like, I don't care. Like, no one cares because it's, I don't know how to explain it. I think later on in the other books, sexuality becomes more relevant to the story that she's trying to tell. But otherwise, it's like, well, yeah, you know, here's a gay person. It's like, all right, okay, maybe if you have read, if I had read the books when they came out a few decades ago, it would have been more like shocking, maybe is the word, really, like, to see, oh, he's a homosexual person in fantasy, where, you know, traditionally the men were, you know, your Conan like warriors, and the women were your, you know.
And I think that is what she was questioning. She was saying, well, here is somebody who doesn't present as this muscle-thewn man, but who is called a man. And the confusion that Starling had with that, that she was just unable to reconcile this androgynous person as a man. And I thought that was quite subtly done, and I appreciated that.
Yeah.
But if I'm going to talk about Starling, what did you think of Kettle and her reveal? The old lady that they travelled with to see the White Prophet, who then went with them.
I really liked Kettle. Just her character in general. I thought that she was a nice addition to the quest. I was not expecting that reveal. And then in the end, that sacrifice, I thought that just in general, the ending was so extremely hard-hitting. But in a way, Robin Hobb could just introduce characters in the third book and make you care for them. I found that was extraordinarily done.
I can't recall that one at all. I'm really sorry.
She was the old lady who Fitz helped when he travelled through the mountains before he got captured at the river. And she made her way to the mountains on her own to find the White Prophet, and she followed them when they went searching for Verity and then became part of the party. And then she had a reveal at the end as a punished skill user who'd been locked in her own mind, but she was very powerful with the skill. She taught Fitz the stone game to help him focus and concentrate. And I liked Kettle when she was Kettle. I didn't like Kettle when she became Kestrel. And I thought it was really amazing that Robin Hobb could make her so different once that part of her character was unlocked, that I could have a different opinion on this woman.
Right.
I remember being really quite astonished at that. Were they secrets, or were you just not told a thing? Because not knowing something doesn't mean it was a secret.
Yeah. And I think that comes back to
a lot.
Yeah. Just because it's all from Fitz's POV. And I also wonder, sometimes he just maybe doesn't mention things because he's telling you his life story. He cannot mention everything. So he writes down what he finds important.
Yeah.
And what he still remembers after all these years.
I'm sorry. I adore Fitz, but he's not very clever.
He has his limitations.
He's the fool as well, isn't he? He's Fitz the fool. So talking about female characters, and again, everything that Robin Hobb does in Fasir, she keeps getting better and better in the later book. But the character of Ketriken, the queen, she is very heroic in the books as well. Not in the way that, you know, traditionally we expect male characters to be heroic, but what her, obviously, the philosophy of the Mountain Kingdom to what it means to be king or queen,
absolutely,
in contrast to the Six Duchies, and how she follows her beliefs or ideals or the philosophy, whatever you want to call it, and how she is so supportive and encouraging of Verity and everything she goes through. No one writes better female characters than Robin Hobb, as far as I'm concerned, that I've read.
I'm not going to disagree with that. I'm 100% behind you on that one. I love Ketriken. What I loved was that she gave Ketriken such a, and it's a theme that we all know she touches on a lot, around agency and being able to, you know, drive her own choices. Ketriken doesn't actually get a lot of choices in Farseer. She just kind of has to go with what's happening. But where she does have agency, she uses it in a way that nobody expects, and in doing so changes so much around her. When they did the cleansing of Buck, when they went out after the Forged Ones under Queen Ketrigan, instead of it being a hunt for these monsters, it was instead a gathering of the people we've lost. And I thought that was just so incredibly powerful that she used that agency in that moment to really stamp how she felt about people.
Yeah.
Because she just didn't get many chances to do that. And I loved that when she did, it was so impactful.
Mm-hmm.
I just love her. I love her.
I agree.
She's excellent at character building because she spends the time to show you, if not the backgrounds, then clear motivations as to why. And I think that's so important. I mean, it's clearly, this trilogy, I think, is clearly almost 90% character, 10% plot. I think the first book is just character, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're
getting those key moments that build who Fitz is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And, absolutely.
The first book is just introducing us to people. The last book is them wandering through the mountains, and even the final battle gets resolved off page. So forget about that.
Yeah.
So what are we doing here? We're just getting to know and
share. Yeah, pretty much. But and you want to be around mm-hmm. them, and you want to know what they're doing and why they're doing it, and because they're engaging and they're so well written. I know that for the longer, and if I'm honest, probably still to this day, Patience is probably one of my favourite characters in all of Realm of the Elderlings, and she gets so little page time. But what she does get is very fleshed out. She's a very real character, and her emotions are so visible, mm-hmm. even to Fitz, who's always very observant. And I just adored her character. So, like, mm-hmm. she brought me to tears so easily. And she isn't a POV person. Nobody is except Fitz. Mm-hmm. She's very rarely on page, and yet she can still wring that emotion from the reader. And you're like, how? It's like she's magic, Robin Hobbs. Like, I don't know how she does that. How does she do that?
Patience is just such a remarkable character, and I think that also the things that happen to Fitz, she feels them, because she views Fitz as her son, and I think because of that you just like her so much immediately, because this is the bastard of her dead husband. A lot of women would not like him and would see him as an inconvenience and just another confrontation of, I didn't have my own child. And instead Patience treats Fitz as her son. And then she thinks that he's dead at the end of the second book, I think. She makes sure that he can get a proper burial. And that's so heartbreaking. And at the end of the trilogy, I was thinking, is this the end? Is Patience going to think that Fitz is dead until the day she dies? That's so heartbreaking. And I think that because of that, I just really cared for her. Because those couple of moments, you can see her heartbreaking.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, when she and Lacey visit Fitz in the dungeons, and you just know that her heart is breaking and she wants to be able to do something. And much like Ketrigan, she doesn't have a lot of agency, but when she when she does use it, she uses it in unusual ways. she's an unusual lady, Patience. You know, she'll dose the guards so they all have to go to the bathroom so that she can get in to see Fitz. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a character moment that I don't think many writers could pull off. And Hobb manages it with just sort of no effort. Like, it's easy.
I've got them there, but when did the first book come out? Was it
1995.
1995. So I think, possibly, it with hindsight, I think it marked a shift in fantasy writing to towards a lot more character focused, character centered stories. Mm-hmm. Because prior to that, I haven't read everything, but I think we were much more steeped into the classic good versus evil, high fantasy kind of world. And I think this, putting it in the context of when it came out, must have been very different.
It was. It really was. I know when I read Farseer the first time, I remember reading Assassin's Apprentice and thinking, I have never read anything like this. There are no elves, there are no dwarfs, there's no, you know, magical, giant, godlike baddie that they've got to come together and fight. I'd never encountered a world like this that felt almost real, and that the magic was easy to follow, even though it didn't have set rules, and it didn't feel like Tolkien. And it was the first time I had read anything that didn't feel derivative of Tolkien. And it set an awfully high benchmark for what I read after that, because so few things compare to having that moment of epiphany that, wow, this is what fantasy can be. And yeah, it did. It was huge. It's the bridge between classic fantasy and what fantasy has become.
Because she still retained elements of fantasy that are largely absent in much more modern series or writers. I mean, maybe Game of Thrones is kind of similar, although there's even less magic. I mean, it's still got the dragons. There's even less magic. I think she managed to strike up a very nice balance between more traditional fantasy and this more character-based, nuanced sort of fantasy that we are getting now, where we've swung the pendulum right to the other way, and then we have Paul Abercrombie, which is a fantasy writer in anything but is it just by name, because he's not writing fantasy, isn't it? But I think her work was pivotal, taken into context.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm old enough to remember. there wasn't a lot of variety in fantasy for a really long time. There was Tolkien, and there was books like Tolkien, and there were copies of books that were like Tolkien, and books that were like the books that were like the books that were like Tolkien. There really wasn't different fantasy where you did get that character development, and the animals were more than just the animal that you could tell to do something. They had an opinion of their own. They got to be characters, not just sidekicks. And to read the relationships that she built that felt like real relationships, not just, oh yes, I love my mum and dad and we had a lovely life, but I am leaving the farm and we're never going to talk about them again. You don't notice that that's what fantasy has been doing until you read a book where that's not what they do, where that family relationship remains important and those things that you learnt about the character stay with the character and become habits or become bad habits or become ways of thinking. They're not a blank page. They've been formed by the characters around them. And it was pivotal in character development, I think, because before it was, okay, we have a young person who's on an adventure. They know nothing. Mm-hmm. They have no baggage. Exactly. They have no habits. Everything about them is going to be formed from this moment. Mm-hmm. So to have this three-dimensional, fully formed person with all of these relationships, some good, some bad, some just annoying, where there's not a, I mean, how many books do you read where the main character's bully for 5 pages is a name you remember 5 books later when he uses it as a cover name for himself?
not outside of fantasy.
Yeah. Definitely.
It blew my mind the first time I read Farseer. It really did. I mean, I can look back and see the flaws in it, but it doesn't change the fact that it was just so different from everything I'd read. It just blew me away.
I mean, I don't think Farseer is her best trilogy.
No.
My appreciation of it has only improved after I've read the subsequent books.
Yeah.
I think a couple of years ago, I think I did like my fantasy series ranking sort of out of 10. And I think I had only read Farseer at the time and I gave it a 6 because,
yeah,
you know.
Makes sense.
The disappointing ending, the crap antagonist, the, you know, all that kind of stuff. But if I was probably to rank Realm of the Underlings as a whole, it would be a lot higher than that.
And I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. If you went back now and reread Farseer, you would rate all of those books much more highly because the things that she wrote in 1995, she manages in a book she writes 20 years later. She manages to weave those threads through the tapestry she wove in a book 20 years ago. And it just enriches the whole thing to read it once you've got the whole picture because it's all there. And you didn't know it was all there. She didn't know it was all there, but it's all there. And just, it's mind-boggling.
I don't know how you feel. Like, every time I pick up a new fantasy series set in a different world or universe I haven't read before, I've always got this sort of nagging feeling in the back of my head, like, oh, my God, like, it's a new world. It's a whole new setting I need to learn. There's potentially new magics I need to understand before getting there. So almost like reluctant to start a brand new fantasy series. So I approach Farseer with the same mindset, like, and also because maybe, oh, I like Tolkien or I like Forgotten Realms, and this is different and it's not what I'm used to. But it was very easy to get familiar with the world she's created. And it feels almost very, like the cover of the paperbacks are amazing. It's all this sort of very chivalric medieval England type thing that it makes it all very easy to get sucked in.
I
do agree. I think that part of it is also that you're walking alongside a child. So, of course, the world is new for him. He meets new people. So it's almost like it's spoon-fed to you at certain moments. Fitz is also learning the skill. And then the wit he tries to find out himself. And that doesn't always work out that well. I think that that he met Night Eyes and that turned out well, I think is extremely extraordinary. And that's more an exception as a rule. If I'm not mistaken, I think in the third book, he also meets like the guy with his bear.
Yeah.
And there he learns a lot, which I found very interesting to read about. And that was an extra character that you don't really see a lot of that I found very endearing to learn from.
Yeah, Black Rolf was great. And the bear was lovely. The funny thing is that you've gone, he learned a lot there. That's not when he went and learned that. We find out about that in the beginning of Tawny Man. Because he didn't go and learn from Black Rolf until after the events in the mountains. But we link that together because that's when we met Black Rolf. But he literally spent an afternoon at Black Rolf's house. That was it. And kept going. And on his way back to the Six Duchies, after everything happened, is when he spent time with them. But again, Robin Hobb. It's a few pages of a character that you've never met before, you don't see again in the trilogy, but he makes a profound difference to the characters, both of Fitz and Night Eyes, and both of them reference Black Rolf and Night Eyes at later points. And very few authors do that, to keep that sense that they are actually living a life where it's connected to these previous points. I love it. Love it. So much. Yeah.
And I think that's why I was so in love with the trilogy from the start. I think that you, Jose, have read more fantasy before that. But for me, I read like A Song of Ice and Fire a little bit over 10 years ago. I fell in love. But then a couple of years ago, I wanted to get back into fantasy. So I picked up all the big ones, Lord of the Rings, Wheel of Time, and then this one, because this was recommended as well. I'm not the biggest fan of Wheel of Time. I'm not the biggest fan of Lord of the Rings. And then I picked up this one and I thought it's going to be quite similar. So, and especially then with the assassin in the title, I thought, oh, yeah, it's going to be another one that everybody else loves, but somehow I just don't really understand what's here. And then all of a sudden it all clicked. And I was thinking, wow, this is present in fantasy. Where can I find more of it? So I was just really blown away by it. And I think that that's why I like the Farseer trilogy so much, even upon a first read, even after years have passed, and I can now look back at it and see that there were definitely flaws. But while I was reading it, yeah.
Yeah.
To me, it's one of those series which I am enjoying and I'm getting to like better in spite of the flaws. I recognize the flaws and I go, you know what? Fine. Because the good far outweighs the bad, which is not what I can say about The Wheel of Time. I can't even begin to comprehend that they were more or less happening sort of simultaneously.
Yeah.
We had this drivel of 14 awful books compared to these gets better by the book 14 book series. And why is The Wheel of Time sold 80 million books and Elderlings is where people are crazy, right?
They are.
Wake up. And as an adult, I could pick up Elderlings now and really enjoy them as an adult, whereas the fantasy I was reading in my teens was very much teenage fantasy because I fell into it through playing Dungeons and Dragons. So as an adult, if I picked Dragonlance or I picked Forgotten Realms or I picked something like that, I would go, God, this is for kids. I still love them because I've grown up with them. And I still read them so often. I understand that, although I would still like for people to read Dragonlance a bit more because I think it deserves a bit of love. But this is adult reading, and it's not just the fantasy. It's not just the quest for the dragons. It's not just to defeat the evil guys that are forging the civilians of the Six Duchies. There are deep themes that make for, I mean, my God, I'm finishing Rainwell Chronicles and sometimes it's like I've got to put the book back because, like I said, as a parent, it's like, you know,
it is very hard.
It's like, makes me think about the kids. It makes me think about everything that I've done, and it really does tug at the heartstrings. And it's like, no, forget the title, forget the dragon's bed, forget the fantasy bit. This is really good writing.
Yeah, it really is. It's beautiful. I mean, as a piece of character-driven prose that happens to have a little bit of magic in it, it's exceptionally well written. I don't know if Jimmy's still watching, but he had Stephen Erickson in a chat a few months ago now, who wrote, obviously, the Malazan Book of the Fallen. And Stephen Erickson was talking about how well Robin Hobb uses POVs, in that she uses it just so incredibly deftly to give you information that you as the reader can see the importance of, even as the person who's telling you about it doesn't know the import of what they're telling you. Mm-hmm. That she developed a magic system where even in a single person POV, you get glimpses of what's happening in other places and with other characters without breaking that sense that you just are still in Fitz's head. And for somebody as accomplished as Stephen Erickson, who's written an amazing series as well, I mean, Yolene, you know this, to see the quality of that, I found very satisfying as a Robin Hobb fan to listen to that, because it's somebody who knows what they're talking about as far as writing is concerned, saying, yeah, she does it really well. So I did find that very satisfying.
although I will counter that with the magic systems, she's not particularly creative. I mean, the skilling is just telepathy, effectively. There's nothing, to my mind, so I don't think that's particularly creative. And the whole witch thing and animal bonding, the trope of the boy and the wolf,
yeah,
is a trope. We've seen it many times in the past. So I don't think there's anything particularly creative there, but it's easy to understand. So, you know, people, we can run it, like, you understand skilling pretty quickly because...
Oh, yes, yeah.
You know,
it's not some weird... kind of
right,
yeah,
it's not some convoluted Brandon Sanderson magic system which requires a 10 page info dump to understand. So I think in that regard, you know, there's no extra points for that, but there are two ideas very well executed.
Very well. And again, when the two of you get into the final trilogy, and again, I go to, she managed to weave concepts in a book she wrote recently into a tapestry she began weaving 20 years ago. She manages to bring those things together and interweave them just so beautifully that it's really difficult, if you don't know, to realize that she didn't have it all planned out, because it feels very organic. It feels very natural that yes, this, of course, this is how it's going to go, even though you had no clue that that's where it could go. And the magic systems are part of that, in that this part of the world treats magic this way and this part of the world treats magic this way, and how you see those similarities and you start to think, are they connected? Are they the same? Is it the same thing that they're just using differently? And to slowly see this all sort of get woven together as the series progresses. So absolutely, if you're reading Farseer for the first time, it's just a fairly simple magic system. It's very soft. It's not complicated. You can follow it really easily. The further you go in the series, the more you start to see how subtle and nuanced some of that has been all along, that has led into other things. And I'm often saddened by the fact that a second read gives you that whole other level, because it's like, yeah, it's great, it's really great, and people read it one time and go, it was pretty good. I'm like, read it again, because now you'll know all the things and you'll see how amazing it is. And it's just, it's astonishing, the levels.
So, I've got a final thought before we go. We've been here for over an hour. I'm shocked.
Yay. My
wife and the kids aren't back yet, so I don't want to have to spoil it. But that's a final thought. I can see two different entry points in Realm of the Otherlings with pros and cons. Just spell me. Because I think they got pros and cons depending on where you start. So would you suggest someone starts here, knowing that perhaps it's not the strongest of the trilogies within the series? Or the other possible entry point I would consider is Lightship Traders, which would be our next discussion, and which I rank above Farseer Trilogy. So,
okay.
And then backtrack, do Farseer, and then move on chronologically. Those are the two entry points I would consider. What would you say to that?
For me personally, I would always recommend Farseer. Just because, first of all, in the Lightship Traders Trilogy, what happens in the Farseer trilogy is a little bit spoiled. So just chronologically, I think it's easier to start with Farseer, then go into Liveship Traders. Also, in Tawnyman, there is definitely a time jump between Farseer and Tawnyman. I think you feel that better if you've read the Liveship Traders in between. The only reason when I would say, no, don't do it that way, start with Liveship, is if you've tried the Farseer trilogy and it's not for you. Because I think if you don't like the Farseer trilogy, if you would DNF it, you will also not like the Tawnyman trilogy, for me at least, because it feels so similar. So then I would just say, read the Liveship Traders trilogy. It's beautiful on its own. And then at least you have still experienced Robin Hobb's writing style and just a beautiful trilogy. But if you, if you're just starting and you might like the Farseer trilogy, just start with that.
That was much gentler than my approach. I am very not okay with people starting with Liveship.
I will self-flagellate when we go off the screen.
It really bothers me when people are like, oh, you can start with Liveship. No. Just no. Everything that happens in Liveship makes what happens in Farseer meaningless, because what you learn in the Liveship Traders proves the people in Farseer wrong about so many things. So how can you become invested in their story after you've read Liveship and you're watching these guys just wasting their time? And
only because if I was trying to get someone hooked onto Realm of the Otherlings, I think Liveship is
make the exception. If somebody tells me they're going to put it down and never return, please read Liveship.
Yeah, see.
Because as Yolene said, at the very least, you're getting a trilogy that is written amazingly well and is satisfying in itself. But if they don't connect to Fitz, it's highly unlikely they're going to enjoy all of Realm of the Elderlings, because it hinges so much on Fitz, and you kind of need to be connected to him to get any enjoyment from it.
So spoiler ahead, because we're hoping to meet up again and discuss Liveship next. We'll put a date, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I cannot fault Liveship. I couldn't find
anything brilliant
I didn't like. Whereas I could find faults with Farseer, I could say to someone, look, read Liveship, because it's, dare I say, almost perfect.
It's almost perfect.
And then you want to go back, read Farseer, and then you're off the track, into this world.
I don't disagree. That's lying. I do disagree. I agree with what you're saying, because and you can quote me anywhere you like, because I've said it everywhere in all of the discords I haunt. Liveship is probably the best technically written part of the Realm of the Elderlings. There is nothing you can question about that trilogy. It is perfection. There are a lot of flaws with Farseer, but if you don't have that connection to Fitz, none of it matters. And for all that Liveship is so brilliant, and it's brilliant, I don't love it the same way as I love Liveship. I don't have the same emotional connection to the Liveship trilogy as I do with any of the Fitz trilogies.
Agree. Yeah.
And
I think the problem,
that's where I think,
the problem with Elderlings is that I think Hobbes' best characters and best interactions are Fitz and the Fool.
Yeah.
But she writes better when she's away from them. And I think Liveship and Rain Wilds, to me, are the most flawless out of all the series I've read.
Exactly.
For as much flack as Rain Wilds gets, I'm halfway through the last book. And again, I can find very little fault with it.
They're actually really good.
So she does better away from her best two characters, which is,
It is mind-blowing when you put it like that. It is, because you're right. The world building that she is able to achieve in Live Ships and is able to achieve in the Rainwilds is phenomenal. And they bring an incredible amount of richness to the story. But again, without Fitz and the Fall at the heart of it, there isn't a story, because they're what holds it all together. And if you haven't found that connection to Fitz,
because as much as I want to say
it's a series for everybody, it's not, because if you don't love Fitz, it's probably not for you.
And I think that they're the Live Ship Traders trilogy, and in extension, maybe the Rainwild Chronicles as well, is maybe more for everyone, because it's a little bit more like what we see in other fantasy stories as well. You have a more unique magic system, if you will. You have a multiple POV cast. You have a stronger plot. I think what
and
she does
a much stronger villain.
Yes, yes. Wow. Amazing. We need to talk about him next stream, because
oh yes, we will.
But what she does with Fitz and the Fool, it goes deeper almost. So I don't really mind the flaws, because what she explores there goes farther than what we see in other fantasy stories. But it's either your cup of tea or it's not. And it's completely fine if you don't like that. But
no, and I think Live Ship, particularly Live Ship, leaves a lot of questions unanswered. And as I'm finishing Rainwilds, they're not getting answered either. So now I really want to see how Fitz and the Fool brings everything together, and I really hope it does. But I'll get there eventually.
Yeah. All I ever say to people when they're like, "Oh, do I start?" I'm like, after all of those books, she nails the landing. And if you're gonna read that many books, that's a good thing to know.
Yes. That
brilliant.
You'll be okay with how it ends.
Fantastic stuff. Derry, Julian, this has been amazing.
It's been lovely.
Really, I've had fun.
Thank you for the two of you. I mean, it's still in the morning for you. So this is,
it is. I'm a bit frightened to look at the sports results now and see how my team did.
And everyone that has been watching, thank you very much for the interaction. Thank you for popping in. Thank you for your thoughts. Thank you for saying hi. And
thank you for inviting us.
We will reconvene at some point to discuss Live Ship next, right?
Yes,
absolutely.
So we'll take it from there. But until next time, everyone, take care, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
And